Okay, good morning, everyone. I'm going to call the remote hearing of Human Services to order. I want to thank Vice Chair Bonner for chairing our meeting yesterday. We have several bills to hear today, and then we're going to meet tomorrow at 10:30 to hear a couple of bills. So I hope you can join us on Friday. With that, we're going to take...
Madam Chair.
Go ahead, Representative Albright.
Good morning, Chair. I'm just wondering what that meeting tomorrow, if you'll be sending out via Chubhub or something, coffee and donuts for each one of the members?
I wish I could do that. Maybe we can figure that out together, Representative Albright. We should do that before session ends. Okay, members, with that, we're going to take the roll. Ms. Hansen?
Good morning, everyone. Chair Schultz?
Present.
Vice Chair Bonner?
Present.
Lead Albright.
Good morning, Lindsay.
Good morning. Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Burkle.
Present.
Representative Fisher.
Fisher, present.
Hi. Representative Frederick.
Present.
Representative Hansen.
Present.
Representative Keel.
Present.
Representative Liebling. Representative Moeller.
Present.
Representative Knorr.
I'm here. Good morning.
Good morning. Representative Novotny.
I am also right here.
Thank you. Representative Pearson.
Pearson, present.
Thank you. My representative, Representative Pinto, I see you.
Present.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, present.
Representative Robbins.
Present.
Thank you. Representative Sandel.
Present.
Thank you. Representative Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Thank you, sir. We have a quorum, Chair Schultz.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen, for taking the role. Let's see. Representative Bolden, would you like to move the minutes from March 10th?
Yes, Madam Chair, so moved.
Okay. Any discussion from the of the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. Thank you, members. Okay, so the first item for consideration today is House File 780. This will be laid over for possible inclusion in the Human Services Finance Bill. I'm going to move to adopt the division report from the Preventing Homelessness Division. This is going to be a voice vote. So all those in favor of adopting the division report, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the division report is adopted. Welcome, Representative Ryer. Your bill's before the committee. Please tell us about it.
Thank you and good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. Thanks for the chance to bring House File 780 forward for your consideration. We're all aware that homelessness is a growing problem, and in the Preventing Homelessness Division, people who have experienced homelessness have told us that having a safe home with services to help address their individual challenges can be the resource they need to break the cycle. Since 1995, we've had a demonstration project in place known as the Metro Demo Project. House File 780 strategically and cost-effectively expands and updates this program, continuing its evolution from the program originally known as Group Residential Housing, or GRH. Many homeless individuals also have challenges with mental health and substance abuse issues, so this expansion would create the resources immediately to provide needed housing connected with services for single adults and families. This proposal came to me from Dakota and Scott Counties and the Minnesota Intercounty Association, or MICA. I'm pleased to say that this bill has bipartisan support in both the House and Senate, highlighting our shared commitment to addressing homelessness. Here's what the bill does. Increases the Metro Demo from 226 units to 500 units over the course of 3 years. Expands the Metro Demo to the entire 7-county metro area by adding Scott, Carver, and Washington counties, and updates language to reflect the current uses of the program. These beds are managed across the region, not county by county, as part of a metro-wide collaborative. Costs for these projects will be phased in over 3 years, and according to the fiscal note, will be about 3.1 million in fiscal year 22 and 23 and 9.2 million in fiscal years 24 and 25. With me today are Madeline Kessler from Dakota County and Danielle Fox from Scott County, who represent the collaborative and who will provide additional information about the program. I'll look forward to your questions and ask for your support for this important legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ryer. And I will note this had great discussion in the Preventing Homelessness Division, and it had unanimous support. So hopefully we'll hear more about that when we hear from our testifiers. The first one I have listed is Madeline Kessler from Dakota County. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Madeline Kessler with Dakota County Social Services. In partnership with the Seven County Metro Area and MICA, Dakota and Scott Counties are proposing an expansion of the Metro Demo Project to provide housing and services for people experiencing homelessness. As you know, there's a focused effort to end homelessness at all levels of government. And while the problem seems daunting, the solutions are really straightforward. People need a place to live, they need a way to pay for that place and support services. The proposed expansion of Metro Demo is a unique way to quickly expand access to both rental assistance and support services. The demo project mimics traditional rental assistance with a person paying 30% of their income toward rent. When a demo participant transitions onto another rental assistance resource like Section 8, they can retain their support services, which creates important services continuity, and the vacated demo rental assistance can then be recycled to a new person. Currently, statute provides 226 demo spots in Hennepin, Ramsey, Dakota, and Anoka counties. The bill before you expands Metro Demo by 274 spots to an even 500 and adds our three other Metro County partners, Carver, Scott, and Washington counties. The metro area counties, under a formal cooperative agreement, jointly manage these resources and funnel them to places where our system is stuck. We will phase in the new resources over a three-year period and also divide new and the existing assets among the metro counties equitably based on our metro needs analysis. We recognize that we're not trying to solve for the whole of homelessness through this proposal. Metro Demo is one piece of the puzzle, and the request to increase demo spots by 274 reflects that balance. Thank you very much for your time and consideration. I'm going to hand it over to Danielle Fox from Scott County, who will speak to the data and outcomes we have seen with the current demo program, and I'll share some slides on the screen while she speaks. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kessler. Daniel Fox, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you and good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Daniel Fox, the Adult Social Services Manager for Scott County. Scott County is one of the counties who is not currently utilizing the demo project due to current legislation, but we hope to in the future due to the great recorded success this program has seen. As Madeline mentioned, this program is targeted at those who are experiencing homelessness and have additional barriers due to mental illness, chemical health, and or HIV. While all experiences are different, we typically see these households have high barriers, yet the demo project has been able to successfully keep people in stable housing, support them in addressing their service needs, and increase their personal income, which in turn increases the contribution to the program overall. The demo participants on average have seen an increased income by 56% while on the program and have maintained a 6.6-year housing stability. Individuals and families are given the opportunity to live with dignity independently in their own home, and the coordination of supports they receive drastically impacts their need for deeper end services. You'll see on the screen and in your handout a visual of the success people have had in this program and the experience cost savings that stability has provided. Each vertical column in this image is a month, and each horizontal line is a person. The colors on the side demonstrate the various settings we typically see this population cycle through when experiencing homelessness, The primary color that you see here is green. That's good. That's a period of stability for the person or the household in the demo program or another permanent housing option. Black is homelessness, red is jail, and the other orange and yellow show more costly staff settings. You can see here that churn of these people or these families who are in and out of these various systems. And if we take a closer look at some of those lines in particular, you'll see a single adult who has spent over 10 years prior to the demo project in an adult foster care setting. The typical cost of that adult foster care could be $300 to $400 a day or $9,000 to $12,000 per month and is paid for by state and federal waiver dollars. On the demo project, once moved into that system, they maintain some level of in-home supports. Maybe they have a PCA provider who provides 4 hours of services a day and $241 a month for demo services and $733 for that average rent. Which brings us to a total annual savings for that one individual between $3,000 and $109,000, all while we're able to increase that person's independence and overall quality of life. If you take a look at another line item and one we heard from our community service providers when talking about individual circumstances, a single adult who's been experiencing homelessness for almost 10 years and has had periodic mental health crises. They had cycled in and out of camping to shelter, which can cost between $50 and $80 a day. They have contact with law enforcement and spend time in jail, which in Scott County costs us about $151 a day. They experience hospitalizations. They require the Anoka Regional Treatment Center at almost $1,300 a day. And following that, an intensive residential treatment or an ERTS facility at around $425 a day. As that cycle continues, resources are needed from homeless outreach teams, mental health outreach teams, case managers, police officers, treatment centers, our hospital emergency departments and inpatient staff, our jail employees, our corrections staff. The list just continues on. Following the demo project, there still might be a need for this individual to access mental health facilities and other resources, but it was at a fraction of what it was during their periods of homelessness. As the program statistics have shown, these households are also highly likely to increase income while participating and therefore making the program itself more cost effective over time as their contribution goes up for rent. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee for this opportunity. We're happy to take any questions that you have at this time.
Thank you, Ms. Fox, for that presentation. We appreciate it. We also have Nancy Selesky from MICA here, and she's available for questions from members. Representative Ryer, do you have any to add before we go to questions from members, Representative Ryer?
No, I would like to say just that it was a very good discussion in the Preventing Homelessness Division. We talked a lot about the ripple effects and the benefits, exploring that in how did that work and why did it work, and then also talked about the cost, and we didn't have the fiscal note at the time, so we do have that information now.
Thank you, Representative Ryer. We do have a fiscal note, but I don't think it includes a lot of the savings you realize with those ripple effects that counties will experience once people are in stable housing. So I think it's not a complete picture of the cost savings. It just has the cost of providing these beds. Is that correct, Ms. Representative Ryer?
Yeah, if you look at it in terms of being a cost-benefit analysis, it's the cost, but the benefits are not quantified there. And I think that's just how the process works. And we need to then amongst ourselves, remind ourselves of the benefits, which happily in this case, we have some track record and some information.
Thank you, Representative Ryer. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Ms. Fox. It's good to see a Scott County resident. Just a question and for you or for the representative from, is it Carver? I forget, Ms. Kastler. But in the bill itself, you're removing the requirement for 70% of housing units to be provided to adults that are suffering from mental illness, substance abuse, or HIV after having been discharged from their facilities. I'm wondering why that stipulation has been removed.
I can take the answer to that question. Madam Chair, Representative Albright, we have removed some of that specificity in the language about who to serve so that we can have maximum flexibility to target these resources where our system is currently stuck. The county social services, we don't have rental assistance resources that we have access to and control over. This is one of the very few where we can have some control over where that resource goes based on current information. And so having that language in the bill that specifies where it needs to go and to whom very specifically it doesn't give us the flexibility we need to say right now. For example, we have a lot of folks across the Seven County metro area in hotel-based shelter. We need tools to be able to help people move from there into housing. And that's a place where our system right now is stuck. And we need to help create some flow from hotel-based shelter into longer-term housing. With this, with some more flexible language in the statute, we can take the demo spots and target them to hotel shelter because we know that's where the need is right now. And then as we do analysis over time, we can say, okay, folks exiting institutions, that's a place where a system is stuck, or exiting treatment facilities, we can have that flexibility. So that's what we're trying to do by taking that language out.
Thank you, Ms. Kassler. And members, I am going to limit questions to two because we have a big policy bill to discuss later. So Representative Albright?
And just to confirm then, it's not the intent of not serving those folks. It's actually to kind of remove the sticking points in terms of how you access help for those people in their various settings. And you can just nod or say yes. And
that's correct. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Let's see. Next up is Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. My question is similar to Representative Albright's. It concerns me, and I appreciate your answer, but it concerns me that we're taking out the language that's really targeting people with mental illness, substance abuse problems, HIV, and people who have been discharged from these treatment centers. Because those are the people, as Ms. Fox testified, that we've really been able to move the needle on. And so perhaps rather than taking that language out, which really is what's been driving assistance towards those populations that are so difficult to serve, you could just add in living on the street or in a shelter, and then the rest of the language is deleted, but maybe you could instead hotel or something and add in hotel, but leave the other language to target these populations. Because I'm concerned that if we take our eye off the ball, it will, in the long run, make the program less effective. As was testified to, it's been very effective for these populations. So I would hate to see us take those directions out of statute.
Ms. Kassler?
Madam Chair, Representative Robbins, I appreciate that concern, and we've had a lot of discussion about the impact of taking that language out. What we've found over time in running housing programs and homelessness services programs over long periods of time is whenever we have a resource that's really prescriptive, it ends up making our ability to serve the system as a whole more difficult. If we have to only serve people who fit into these categories, we have less flexibility to maneuver as we need to over time. We know that the situation, homelessness and housing situations ebb and flow over time, and who is experiencing homelessness changes over time. And so whenever we say we need this percentage of people who fit in these categories, it actually makes our job a little bit more difficult to be able to be as nimble as we know we need to be.
I will say, though, the folks that are experiencing homelessness, generally speaking, are meeting all of those criteria. So I know that we're, as a county group, we're not concerned about not serving those folks, because we know there's a high percentage of mental health issues, a high percentage of chemical dependency, physical health issues of people experiencing homelessness. So I feel very confident that we'll be able to hit that target, even if we remove those that specificity in the statute.
I second what Madeline said. I think Scott County has done quite a bit of analysis in our jail data and our coordinated entry housing homeless wait list, as well as our mental health numbers. And as we spoke to some of those examples, I think we see that consistent churn and really want to focus on those individuals and households with high barriers, but make it easier to do so.
Thank you, Ms. Fox. Representative Robbins?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Sandell?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Ryer, I think the bill's a good bill and appreciate the work that the testifiers have done, and I certainly want to support it. 2 years ago, I carried a similar bill coordination with an organization called Supportive Living Solutions, which provided housing in Minneapolis for individuals who were handicapped, face, as Ms. Fox said, special barriers to their living. It came to a vote on the floor as a standalone bill and passed 133-1. The person who voted against it was former Senator Leffler. Diane and I had a number of conversations about the bill, and she was right. The bill did violate the letter of the law when it came to the Olmstead decision of the Supreme Court. It maintained the concentration of individuals in housing. And based on the conversation I've heard here, I'm afraid I guess I haven't heard the testifiers respond to that issue. Will it in any way violate the Olmstead ruling? And if so, how can we make sure that we're doing the best job for all the people who need the housing and support that we're talking about?
Fox?
Chair, Representative, I think this would really go to support the work that the Olmstead Act has been working to do in providing people independence. Individuals would not be in a facility, they would be in their own homes in an apartment with supportive services coming to them. So it allows them a significant amount of choice as far as where they would like to be located, an array of services that they can be offered. And so I think it really does help support our Olmstead work that we've done so far across the state.
Thank you, Ms. Fox. Representative Sandell?
Thanks, Chair and Ms. Fox. As I said, I support the bill, and I'm in Washington County and certainly would like to see something happen over here too. But I do, I am concerned about that issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Ryer, closing comments. And I just want to add my two cents, but I support this bill, and I think it's better that we have more rather than fewer beds to address our needs. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciated the questions and the concern about making sure that we weren't diluting our commitment to people with mental health, chemical dependency, and other issues. I just want to clarify that in the statute, we do not strike out the lines that say that the housing units are for homeless adults with mental illness, a history of substance abuse, or HIV AIDS. And so the very specific language that takes it down into more and more granular detail is removed, but that overarching vision for this program remains. So I just wanted to reassure you on that, because that's important to me as well. I love seeing a program that can demonstrate results like this. I'm a researcher and a data person, so it makes me feel very strong about this bill, and I appreciate all of your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ryer, and thank you to our testifiers today. We appreciate all the information you've provided on this bill. So with that, House File 780 will be laid over for possible inclusion in our finance bill. The next bill for consideration is House File 945. Representative Joachim, your bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the Human Services Finance Bill. I'll move the bill so it's before the committee. Welcome, and please tell us about your bill. Representative Joachim.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for hearing House File 945 today. I know members on this committee are familiar with the mechanism of third-party billing. Our school districts use this to help mitigate the cost in servicing some of our kiddos with special needs. Our school districts are facing deficits this year in particular. They're facing challenges to their budgets and their special ed cross-subsidy is growing. This bill will help mitigate a portion of that gap. Currently, there are a variety of services that a school district can bill Medicaid for when providing for a student who has disabilities and an IEP that requires health-related services in order for them to benefit from special education, and the child is also eligible for Minnesota healthcare programs. These services include occupational therapy, speech, language, and hearing services, as well as therapeutic services and supports. Licensed school social workers can also currently bill for the evaluations and re-evaluations they do for students, but not for the actual services they provide due to the outcome of some of these evaluations. This bill would allow for reimbursement by medical assistance of a licensed school social worker services based on a student's IEP if the services are provided by an individual who holds a master's degree in social work, is licensed by the school board of school. So social work is licensed by PALSB, which is our professional educator licensure standards board, as a school social worker, and currently holds an independent clinical social worker license from the Board of Social Work, or holds a graduate social worker or independent social worker license and is supervised by a licensed independent clinical social worker. Sorry, those are a lot of words. They're in your bill, and I believe they're in your brief as well. Other states have allowed these types of services to be billable to Medicaid and have brought the additional federal money into their state in order to further serve their students. This bill would allow Minnesota to tap into those funds that have been left on the table, funds that could directly support our students who have the most needs. I have two folks here with me today that can further highlight the need for this legislation. There's Scott Hare, who's the Director of Special Services from Mankato Public Schools, and Kathy Dalness, Manager of Social Work Services from Minneapolis Public Schools.
Thank you, Representative Joachim. Scott Hare, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation and then proceed with your testimony.
Yes, I'm Scott Hare. I'm the Director of Student Support Services for Mankato Area Public Schools and also a past president of the Minnesota Association for Special Education Administrators. Chair and committee members, thank you for allowing us to testify on such an important bill. I could spend a lot of time talking about the value of social workers, especially when it's School Social Worker Week. They provide so much support for our students in the areas of social-emotional learning. We have students that are experiencing trauma that they help our students with. They help build resiliency for our students. And they work diligently with our families and many families that are homeless in finding resources to provide support for our students. They do this in collaboration with administration, collaboration with county people, as well as collaboration with our teachers and support staff. All this in the area of providing good mental health services for our students. I want to share with you just a brief story in regards to an email I received from one of our special education teachers 2 weeks ago. Mankato Area Public Schools is going through budget reductions. We have to trim $7.5 million from our budget for next school year. So I received an email from one of our special education teachers where we've had a pilot program going for 2 years. I added a school social worker who would fall under the categories that you, Representative Joachim talked about, to that program in which they're providing mental health support for this program. So I have four programs like this across the district. They're known as center-based programs, more of a self-contained classroom for students exhibiting behavioral challenges. This is at our elementary level. Our goal was to keep students from having to be placed in a much more restrictive environment. So for instance, if you up in the metro area, they might get sent to an intermediate district. Down here, we don't belong to an education cooperative or intermediate district. We have our own offsite program. For the last 2 years, with the help of this social worker, working with our teachers, our families, but most importantly with our students, we have not sent one student to a more restricted environment. That's incredible. And I go back to the value of this social worker providing mental health support to our students in those programs. It has been mentioned in regards to the budget and what school districts face today. I did mention that Mankato Area Public Schools has to trim $7.5 million. Our crossover subsidy on a yearly basis is approximately $7 million to this district. because of COVID, we will fall short about $800,000 in revenue from medical assistance this year, not being able to bill for certain services due to COVID. So we're looking at many ways that we can bring additional resources to the district. This is one we're already doing. Our social workers are already doing this service, but we're unable to bill for them. It's very important that we're allowed to do this to increase the revenue, but most importantly, to deliver the services to students. We have done everything we can in this district to provide mental health, everything. We've got school-linked mental health, and I appreciate the grants and the money that has been put forth to school-linked mental health. We have it in almost every one of our schools. We have waiting lists to see those therapists, and those therapists can take on about 5, 6, maybe 7 students. We have Prairie Care, which is a mental health day program that we provide education for students that attend that. But it's still not enough. Every day we have students coming through our doors that have mental health needs. Social workers are there every day working with our students and our families. And in closing, we're not trying to compete with other groups that are trying to provide these services. We're trying to add to the availability to give students the mental health they need. Thank you for hearing my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Hare. And we have a question, Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you very much, Madam Chair. And thank you for the bill and for the testimony. So first of all, I was going to ask, and Mr. Hare addressed it a little bit, about how this interacts, if at all, with the school-linked mental health grants. But so he kind of explained, I think this is somewhat additive to that. So I totally appreciate the fact that the schools are having budget crises and that we've always had the so-called cross subsidy. And I see that the bill is trying to, you know, bring in more revenue from the human services side, from the medical assistance side, actually. I mean, medical assistance paying for services it doesn't pay for yet now, as I'm understanding the bill. And so my question is whether, I was looking at the language of the bill and it refers to a lot of rules and so on, which I don't know exactly what they are, but does this require a federal waiver? Is this, are these services gonna qualify just as they are now? And it's just a matter of us allowing it under state law. And then I assume, of course, that there's got to be a big fiscal cost to this, which is kind of the reason for the bill in the first place, as I understand it. So if you could address those things, it would be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. We don't have a fiscal note yet, but Representative Joachim, did you want to answer the question?
Yes, Representative Schultz. I think my next testifier, Kathy Dalmas, will be able to go into this a little bit more. But the services are being provided, Representative Liebling, and like you said, they are not able to bill for them right now. But Kathy Dalmas will be able to explain this a little bit better. And I'm not sure what the fiscal note will look like because it would be reimbursed by Medicaid, but you guys know that better than me. So if we could go to the next testifier.
We will go to the next testifier. Thank you, Representative Joachim. Ms. Dalmas, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation and proceed with your testimony. And I have to limit testimony because we do have a lot of bills to go through. So you have 2 minutes, Ms. Dalmas.
Thank you, Chairman Schultz. My name is Kathy Dalmas. I'm the manager of social work services in the Minneapolis Public Schools and a licensed clinical social worker. I've been a school social worker in Minnesota for 30 years. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this House File 945. Research shows the need for school mental health services has continually increased, and especially now at this time in our state and in our country, our students' mental health needs demand our support and intervention. We're navigating through a pandemic and racial injustice, and our children and adolescents are experiencing trauma, toxic stress, grief and loss, anxiety, depression. School mental health teams, which are school social workers, school-linked therapists, school psychologists, school counselors, our school mental health teams across the states are constantly, they are caring for the mental health needs of our students while also constantly navigating how to fully fund these services. We are asking to access federal Medicaid funds for some of these services, a subset of mental health services. as these funds are a sustainable revenue source. To maximize federal reimbursement, Minnesota requires school districts to seek medical assistance reimbursement for health-related services that are provided as part of an individual education plan, an IEP. Medicaid is the primary payer for IEP health-related services in the schools, yet schools are failing to access these federal funds. District participation in federal Medicaid reimbursements through the current CTSS, Children's Therapeutic Supports and Services System, to support the mental health needs for students receiving special ed has decreased in Minnesota due to the burden of additional paperwork over and above what's already required of special ed. This bill does not suggest that schools would seek Medicaid reimbursement through the CTSS program, but rather it would allow schools to receive federal reimbursement through the IEP or IFSP process. So we're asking to allow mental health services provided by school social workers who are licensed clinical social workers or being supervised by a clinical social worker for students who are special ed and have mental health related services on their IEP. It's really that subset that we're looking at. Similar services, including speech language, occupational and physical therapy, school nursing services, those other health related services, they are all currently reimbursable through Medicaid for eligible students where the IEP comprehensive eval has determined the medical necessity and they are billing for those services that they provide. We know there is some concern about seeking Medicaid reimbursement without doing a diagnostic assessment, but like these other health-related services, we believe the multidisciplinary special ed team can do a comprehensive evaluation, which includes interviewing a parent, looking at the history of interventions, doing observations across settings over a period of 6 weeks. So we believe that, you know, a comprehensive special ed eval can identify students' mental health needs in school. So while school social work services are included under Minnesota statute as health-related services that can bill to MA, our current practice in Minnesota is that we do not allow districts to bill for these. We do bill for the evaluation component, but not for the services that we have identified as necessary on the IEP. Wisconsin, Illinois, and Iowa do allow reimbursement for social work services. Just as an example, some of our neighboring states, Wisconsin generates about $8 million annually in federal reimbursement. Illinois estimates they receive between $15 and $20 million annually. Michigan generates $45 million. Currently, Minnesota generates $3 million in this reimbursement. There's an estimation that this bill would conservatively funnel $10 million into school districts in our state. These funds are federal dollars that have been and are being left on the table. This is in no way taking any funds from another Minnesota program or service to pay for another. It's an attempt to bring in federal dollars to support schools. So in closing, Minnesota School Social Work Association urges you to support House File 945. Which would ensure school districts across the state could access essential revenue support to support some of our most vulnerable students. Thank you for your support on this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Dalness. But we do have to pay for the half, the 50% of the MA services. So we're bringing in federal money, but we do have to be responsible for some of that cost. Is that correct, Ms. Dalness, for this?
I would love to ask either Representative Joachim or Scott Hare to respond to that money question. Chairman Schultz.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. That is a good question. I would have to rely on Scott Hare on this. I know there are some cases where we are doing matching support. I don't know if this is one of them.
Unfortunately,
maybe House Research can help us answer that question. If this is also subject to the 50% match.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Berg.
This is Doug. I am going to say there is a pending fiscal note which has been referred out to DHS and the Department of Ed. I'm wondering if maybe Ms. Bailey or Mr. Burdick can comment. I think that under IEP, Medicaid services under IEPs, that the school district is the responsible party. And so I believe the costs here would show up in the K-12 budget, but maybe either Ms. Bailey or Mr. Burdick can discuss, or Mr. H.
Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, Giogo Hayes with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. To that exact question, the way that IEP billing works in subdivision 26 of this section of law is the schools are the ones putting up the state share, and then we're using that state share to go to the federal government and collect federal federal financial participation to match that. So from a programmatic cost perspective for the HHS budget, there isn't a fiscal impact. We are analyzing the bill for any administrative impact that might be included in the bill.
Thank you. Good to know. So we'll wait for that fiscal note. Representative Joaquin.
I believe, too, got to remember these are services we're already providing our students. So we're already paying for these services. This is a way to recoup some of those costs through MA. So we're already paying for them. So I'll be anxious to see what the fiscal note says.
Me too. Thank you, Representative Joaquin. Representative Mohler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to state my strong support for this bill. Student mental health is a top priority, and I know it is for many members of this committee as well. And just a reminder that Minnesota ranks in the bottom of states as far as ratio of students to counselors, social workers, psychologists, and other school support professionals. And so we need to be doing all that we can do to ensure that our students are getting the mental health services they need. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Mohler. And my questioning in no way means that I don't support this legislation. I do, but as a fiscal chair, I need to understand how the money works. So, Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you. I'm thrilled that Chair Schultz asked that question because it is a key thing for us to understand on this committee. And so my little follow-up question is, and this sounds like a something like, now that I understand that that's how the money works, it's kind of a no-brainer for us, honestly. But would this allow schools to actually hire more social workers to be able to take care of more of these needs? I mean, that would be just a wonderful result because I you know, we all understand that our kids need this service.
We hope that would be the case. Representative Joaquin, to that question, and then closing comments.
Yes.
We need to proceed.
Thank you. I would hope that'd be the case too. One thing I do know is that it would help us chip away at that cross subsidy that's out there. And anytime we can make the bottom line of our school districts healthy, the better all of our students are, and we'll be, and the better we're able to meet their needs. So that is the hope.
Okay. Closing comments. That was it. Thank you. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say thank you so much for taking the time to answer this, to hear this bill and ask the questions and for your comments. We're still working on the language to make sure it's just right so that we can access those federal funds. And thank you for hearing this during Social Worker Week. Social workers play an integral role in all of our children's education. And why this bill focuses in on our kiddos with special needs, social workers work with our entire school population and make our learning environment safe, happy, and healthy. So thank you to members.
Thank you, Representative Joaquin, and to our testifiers. Thank you for being here today. And this seems like a win-win. We can address mental health and help our school districts. Okay, members, this House File 945 will be laid over for possible inclusion. The next item we have for consideration is House File 1685. House File 1685 will also be laid over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Finance Bill. Chair Nelson, welcome to the committee. I'll move House File 1685 so it's before the committee. Please describe your bill. And this, members, this is the SEIU ratification bill. So we've already talked a lot about the PCA contracts and the wage increase, so we're really going to limit questions. But Chair Nelson, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members, for hearing this bill. Again, as was stated, this is House File 1685. It's the ratification of the contract between the state of Minnesota and self-directed care workers that are represented by SEIU. It also should be noted that it also covers the SEIU, independent self-care, self-directed care workers who don't belong to SEIU. They're all part of the bargaining group and they don't have to belong to the union, but it just covers all of them. Last Thursday, this committee heard House File 1434 that funds this contract. The funding is also carried in the governor's human services budget bill. And I expect this ratification language that will soon be added to the bill eventually. The contract was submitted to the Subcommittee Employee Relations, which during the session has an advisory role, and they passed that along on March, or voted on this March 1st of this year. This will be the fourth contract with these workers since the since they gained the right to form the union. And as the author of that bill, I'm proud that the progress has been made. The contract covers approximately 29,000 workers in the three self-directed home care programs. That includes the PCA Choice Program, the Consumer Directed Community Support Program, and the Consumer Court Grant Program. These programs are all self-directed, where the client recruits, hires, trains, and supervises these workers. And the contract, while this contract does not apply to the traditional agencies, the traditional PCA agencies and programs, these workers in the private sector are private sector's employees of those agencies. However, those workers are not covered by the contract, the agencies will receive the same rate increase without the requirement to pass that funding along to the workers. Now, these workers are predominantly women of color, women and people of color. They have been on the front line as essential workers during the COVID-19 pandemic, risking their own health almost always without adequate PPE or paid quarantine leave. They have helped our elderly and disabled live at home and stay out of nursing homes and other institutions, which cost more money. And also some of these group homes and nursing homes have had high rates of COVID infections that have killed far too many of our constituents. This contract is small recognition for their heroic efforts. The contract raises the hourly wage from $13.25 to $14.40 an hour on October 1st of this contract year and $15.25 on July 1st of next year. The higher wages will help fight the enormous workforce shortages we have in the home care industry. Even before the pandemic hit, there were at least 8,000 unfilled home care positions in Minnesota. The shortages grow worse every day as our population ages. In addition, the Minneapolis municipal minimum wage is scheduled to be increased to approximately $15 an hour on July 1st of next year. By ratifying this contract, we keep our self-directed workforce above that level, and it helps ensure the private sector traditional PC agencies have sufficient money to reimburse their employees. In addition to raising the minimum wage, the contract also improves PTO approval, adds 2 days of holiday pay, and adds funding for worker training. The LCC has provided a detailed summary, which is in your packet, of the changes, and an MMB is here available for questions. Finally, I want to highlight 2 important points. First, this is a bipartisan effort. Senator Miller is the author in the Senate Files 1701 in the Senate companion to this bill. I would like to thank Representative Cretia for co-authoring this bill with me. And last week we passed out of State Government Finance Committee on a bipartisan vote. Second, like I said earlier, this is an open shop contract. Although the workers in the unit enjoy the benefits of the contract, no worker is required to join the union or pay any dues or fair share dues. And again, this contract recognizes the value of these essential workers, and I urge your support. And again, we have Jennifer Klassman and Laura Lane here from MMB, and also Rick Markle from SEIU is here to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. And remember, members, this was thoroughly vetted in Chair Nelson's committee. So Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I probably should first reintroduce myself to Chair Nelson. I don't know if you remember me, Chair Nelson, but I sat just to the right of you for several years in one of your committees. So I hope you recognize the name. Just a couple questions for you, Chair. The first one is, what other benefits are tied to the minimum wage or the rate scale itself in terms of their benefit structure going forward, if any?
Well, like I said, they were added.
Chair Nelson.
Madam Chair, sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Albright. And I do recognize you. And although the beard is new, you must be serving as Santa Claus in the off season. But Representative Albright, like I said, they increased 2 floating holidays, 2 additional pay days, but they're floating holidays so people can take them when they need to. It also has increased the number of the accrual of paid time off to 1 hour for every 30 hours worked. Again, that's besides the wages that are going up. So they're getting some additional paid days off.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, my final question is actually pointed to you. Recognizing that this is an important feature of our responsibility to provide compensation for these workers, I'm just wondering, has it already been included in the HHS target as a priority, and how will you and others rectify that financial responsibility in light of kind of the arena of other really good ideas that have come through this committee in the last several weeks? So more of an open op-ed, but certainly looking to you for direction on the inclusion of it in the finance side of the HHS bill that you'll bring forward.
Thank you, Representative Albright. This is a high priority for me and many members of our, most probably all of our members in our caucus, and it's got bipartisan support. So we don't have our budget targets yet. We'll have those soon. And I think that the public knows how passionate I am about increasing wages for our PCAs and direct support professionals. So I don't want to say what the probability is, but it's very, very high. And I just also want to note that the LCC did not vote on this contract. It was just submitted to the LCC. That was just, I don't know if that was stated yet. But with that, any closing comments, Chair Nelson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Like I said in my comments, House File 1434, which you heard last week, is the bill that funds the contract. And I don't know if you laid that over or passed that on, but that's you've already heard that part of the bill. And I thank you for the hearing it, and I hope we end up in your omnibus bill.
Thank you, Chair Nelson, and thank you for all those who worked on it and have supported this increase in the past. With that, House File 1685 is laid over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Finance Bill. Next for consideration is House File 1102. Representative Hansen, would you like to move House File 1102 so it's placed on the General Register?
Yes, Madam Chair, that's my motion. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Hansen moves House File 1102 to be placed on the General Register. Please tell us about your bill.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, for hearing this bill today. I will provide a overview of this bill, and then I will turn it over to our testifiers. We have Joe Club, the Vice President of Operations for Mental Health Services at Allina Health, testifying today, and we also get the opportunity to hear from Sue Hansen, whose outreach and advocacy inspired this bill. This also has the support of the Mental Health Providers Association of Minnesota. And in the Behavioral Health Policy Division, we also received written testimony from Dr. Eduardo Colon from Hennepin Health. And lastly, we have Sue Abderholden with NAMI here to answer questions as well. I also just want to take a second to thank the co-authors of this bill, including Representatives Frankie, Frederick, Berg, and Moeller, and also Senators Housley and Abler, who are carrying this companion bill in the Senate. Lastly, I'd just like to confirm that there is no fiscal note for this. Members, a little over a year ago, we became aware of a glitch in the HCBS waiver system, which prevents what's called double dipping, which means people are not eligible to receive an HCBS waiver while hospitalized or in residential treatment. Logistically, this makes some sense. However, this current state of affairs leaves people with nothing if they are not re-enrolled in the waivers prior to discharge, making it very difficult to holistically help people transition back to the community. This bill will suspend the waivers so that people can return to the level of services they were receiving prior to hospitalization or residential treatment. As it stands today, people receiving an HCBS waiver, such as CADI, CAC, BI, or DD, lose their eligibility after 30 days of an inpatient stay. They are then required to reapply for their waivers and have to undergo another MIN Choices assessment. This can take up to 60 days or more. As you can imagine, this leaves people receiving waivers and their providers in a really tough spot. This bill will suspend the waivers for 121 days rather than discontinuing the services. This saves money and time, and frankly, and most importantly, people's lives. We don't want people discharged to the community without the services that we knew they needed prior to entering care. Home and community-based waivers provide services and supports so that people with disabilities and mental illnesses can live and thrive in the community. And these services are no less needed upon their recovery. Though people may need additional services following discharge, we believe that people should, at minimum, leave a facility with the same level of care that they started with and not be burdened with another waiting period and have to undergo another initial assessment. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to turn it over to our testifiers, beginning with Joe Klub from Alina and then to Sue Hansen, please.
Okay, Representative Hansen. Mr. Klub, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Schultz. Thank you, Representative Hansen and members of the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee. My name is Joe Klub, and as stated, I do serve as the Vice President of Operations for Mental Health and Addiction Services for Alina Health. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 1102 and allowing individuals to maintain their home and community-based services waiver while they receive inpatient and residential care for up to 121 days. Alina Health is one of the largest healthcare and mental health and addiction providers in the state of Minnesota. Many of our mental health professionals have seen the unintended negative impact of the HCBS waiver termination process on individuals who are considering treatment, inpatient treatment or residential treatment, and those who are being discharged back to the community setting. Individuals in need of inpatient and residential care seeking treatment for substance use disorder should not feel they have to choose between receiving care and maintaining their waiver. Eliminating the 30-day automatic termination will allow and eliminate a potential to barrier to care. The application process is complicated. It is actually a three-step process. It's the MnCARES application, it's a determination, and then there's a waiting period for a disbursement of funds. In our experience, this can take up to 90 days to go through the entire process. In my role as the operational leader for Alina Health, Mental Health and Addiction Services, I've witnessed the unnecessary stress and burden on patients whose waiver has been automatically terminated. We operate 250 beds across the state of Minnesota, and we estimate this impacts 10% of our patients. They're forced to navigate a complicated application process while we expect them to manage their recovery from their mental illness and their addiction. In addition to causing undue burden and stress for patients and their families, the termination of the waiver can delay and complicate a discharge back to the community and often back to their home. Allowing individuals to maintain their waiver for up to 121 days reduces barriers to services along our care continuum. We will hold patients in their inpatient bed until they are approved for services and have the funding available to transition. This impacts the continuum of care. We oftentimes have patients who are waiting in our 13 emergency rooms who are in a mental health crisis, waiting for access to one of our inpatient beds. But those beds have patients who are waiting for their funding to be put in place before we can discharge. Thanks for the opportunity to speak in support of House File 1102 and in support of allowing individuals to maintain their level of waiver services while receiving inpatient care. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Klub. Now we'll go to the next testifier, Sue Hansen. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Here I am. Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Schultz and members of the committee, and in particular, Representative Bonner, who happens to be my representative. My name is Sue Hansen, and I am a longtime member of NAMI Minnesota. My husband and I have three grown children. Our youngest son, Joel, is 46 years old, and he has lived with schizophrenia for the past 26 years. It took us over 15 years to get Joel into a stable housing situation with supports in place. He has had over 40 hospitalizations, two long-term stays at Anoka, and I could not begin to count the number of ER visits. We finally got him on a CADI waiver, and the rest of it sort of fell into place not long after that. Joel has now lived in a group home in the community for about 10 years. About a year and a half ago, he ended up in the hospital with catatonia. In fact, this is frequently referred to as schizophrenic catatonia. This is a very serious condition that leaves the person unresponsive, unable to eat or drink, and it very quickly becomes life-threatening. The doctors, of course, did everything they could to keep him alive. He was on IVs, of course, and the day that they were going to put the NG tube into his stomach to feed him more nourishment, he actually began to swallow liquids. This was about 6 or 7 days into this particular hospitalization. This was the longest he could go without more substantive nutrition. He was extremely weak. He was very ill, and he had just started taking his antipsychotics again as well, so it took a while for us to get him back. He was in the hospital for 29 days. The doctors wanted to keep him another week or two until he had stabilized more, until his meds had helped more. In their estimation, he needed a bit more time in the hospital. But because we were afraid of losing his caddy waiver, the supports and housing, on day 30, we asked the doctors to please discharge him. He went back to his group home, and with intensive help from staff, we were able to get him back on his feet. There was absolutely no magic. It was a very slow process, but likely it would have been a bit easier if he'd been able to remain in the hospital longer. To my husband and I, who had been through these 40 plus hospitalizations with him, Joel did not seem well enough to leave the hospital after the 30 days. At the time Joel was hospitalized, his caddy manager stated that it could take 2 to 3 months to conduct the Min Choices assessment and get him back on the caddy. After nearly 10 years with the same provider, it would have been especially difficult to find another provider who would understand his situation as well or provide as much support as he needed. The provider, our own provider, would have been willing to try to work with us, but we couldn't expect them to go without payment for the supports for that length of time. Joel did not need another assessment. He needed to have the supports there for him when he was discharged, no matter how many days he was in the hospital. We cannot imagine what would have happened if he had been discharged on day 40 without any supports waiting for him and without being able to access any for months. In our estimation, even an extension of 2 to 4 weeks would have made all the difference and allowed Joel to get the care inpatient that was needed at that time. I urge you to suspend, not terminate, caddy waivers when people are in the hospital or residential treatment for 30 days or more. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen, for being here today and sharing your story and your experience with your son. I highly recommend the book Fix What You Can by former Representative Mindy Greeling. I believe she served in the House for maybe 20 years, but it's an excellent book to read about her experience with her son and our mental health system. Okay, with that, let's see. I'm not seeing any questions from members. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first, Ms. Hansen, thank you so much for the courage. I know it takes a lot to come before the committee and especially to share your very personal stories about your son and those challenges. So thank you for that. I guess I just wanted to kind of say, I do actually have a question, but first, I know it's really challenging to keep folks both to have the beds available to put someone into a treatment facility, to get them stabilized and get the care that they need to get where they need to be. And then equally as challenging to make sure that they have a safe place to go once they're discharged. And we've talked a little bit here about when someone is discharged, and it was sort of alluded to that when you are in the facility, if, for example, you were to lose your waiver and there is nowhere to send them, that in some cases they may be keeping them in a bed, if I understood correctly, that may be needed for others. But I also wonder if someone could speak a little bit to what happens when that waiver does drop off and there is nowhere for that individual to go. That was one scenario, and I'm not sure if that's the most common. And also maybe a little bit to the cost of having someone stay
staying in a bed that maybe we need to utilize for other patients, and when we could potentially be keeping them in or transitioning them to a more stable environment when they're able to safely go to that next step. And maybe just help me understand what happens when that waiver drops off, and maybe some of the other pieces around it.
Those are great questions, Vice Chair Bonner. I know this was discussed in Chair Fisher's committee at length. So maybe Ms. Aberholden could quickly respond, and then we could follow up with more answers offline.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Member Sue Aberholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. Sometimes what happens is people are discharged to nothing, to homelessness. I know hospitals try not to have that happen, but, you know, it does happen. Sometimes people return back with their families, but again, without any support at all. And sometimes, of course, they stay in too long, and a hospitalization is not cheap. And I'm sure Mr. Club would have some ideas for the cost of that.
Thank you, Ms. Aberholden.
So, Madam Chair Schultz.
Mr. Club, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair Schultz and Representative Bonner, and thank you, Sue. It is our experience that we hold patients in the hospital up to the duration of their funding is back in place. What it does mean for many people is we start over. We search for a new location because oftentimes the home that they lived in has been filled with another community member because the demand is so great. Just for a patient to remain in the hospital for, if you will, the room and board charge, just to simplify, is over $1,000 a day. That does not include any adjunctive charges or any professional fee charges for that individual to be seen by psychiatry, psychology, any other disciplines. So that's a very conservative estimation related to costs of somebody to stay. The costs are also significant to emergency departments, as individuals are staying within our emergency departments days on end, at times waiting for a bed. And you have to realize that emergency rooms operate in hours, not in days. So it's really not a therapeutic setting that has been designed to serve individuals. So Representative Bonner, I hope that helps to answer.
Thank you, Mr. Club. Representative Bonner.
Thank you for that explanation. I really do appreciate that. And, you know, I guess one of the things that strikes me most about this is, you know, certainly we talk a lot about continuity of care and making sure that we have better outcomes for patients, particularly in a situation where we need to transition them. And I know, especially when you have folks who may be in a fragile mental state already, and if we were to have to take them out of an existing home placement situation, and then because that place is no longer available, we're reintroducing them into a new environment, which I can only imagine increases the stress level and makes it more challenging for that individual to transition. And so I guess, you know, it feels like the best possible way to ensure stability for many of these folks is to make sure that they are able to stay on their waiver, that they're able to transition back to a stable and familiar location, and really to ensure that they get the care that they need so they don't end up back in the hospital again. So I really appreciate your follow through. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Bonner. I need to make a different motion. So this, I need to have Chair Fisher move the division report from behavioral health. Chair Fisher?
Madam Chair, yes, I'd like to move the division report, the approval of and acceptance of the division report from my division on behavioral health.
Thank you. Chair Fisher moves the division report from behavioral health. This is a voice vote. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails. And the division report is adopted. Let's see. So now, Representative Hansen, can you make a new motion to place House File 1102 on the Journal Register, please?
Absolutely, Madam Chair. I would like to renew my motion, make a motion to refer House File 1102 to be referred to the General Register, please.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Looks like Representative Albright has a question. Go ahead.
Thank you. Actually, I have a couple of questions for Ms. Abderholden, if she is available.
Ms. Abderholden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Abderholden, you and I share a real concern for the folks that would be applicable to these circumstances. And so my first question is there a benefit to skipping this reassessment? And if there is, are there any risks to this change? And then I have a follow-up.
Ms. Abderholden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Albright. They could still do a reassessment, but you don't have to start all over again. And that's really the big issue. So you still have the waiver. You're entitled to what you had before you went into the hospital or into residential treatment. And if you need more, you can ask for that reassessment. But at least you don't have that period of time of, frankly, months where you're not eligible for anything.
Representative Albright, second question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, and Ms. Abderholden, how often would these reassessments identify changes to a person's waiver plan?
Ms. Abderholden.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, our experience is that they haven't changed a lot. honestly, they might have, upped the number of hours if they were living in their own apartment and not in a corporate foster setting, maybe up the number of hours that someone came in. Which can be handled a little bit easier, again, than starting all over again. But we often find that if people can at least get what they got before, that keeps them going and keeps them stable.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Okay, I'm going to end our discussion. I appreciate Representative Hansen bringing this to us. Do you have a quick 30-second closing comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say, as you've heard, members, this bill is critical to people like Joel and so many other Minnesotans. I want to just pause and thank Sue Hansen for coming forward and sharing her testimony with us. We know that these are hard things to do for our community members to step up, and this bill is what it is because of her advocacy on behalf of her son. So thank you for doing that. I appreciate everybody's support in making this critical change, and I'm looking forward to making this law as soon as we can with our bipartisan support. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hansen renews her motion to place House File 1102 on the general register as recommended. This is a roll call vote. Ms. Hansen, chair votes aye.
Holtz, aye. Vice Chair Bonner?
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Lead Albright?
Aye.
Albright, aye. Representative Bolden?
Aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Burkle?
Aye.
Burkle, aye. Representative Fisher?
Fisher, aye.
Fisher, aye. Representative Frederick?
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Hansen?
Aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Keel?
Keel, aye.
Thank you. Keel, aye. Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative Mueller?
Aye.
Mueller, aye. Representative Knorr?
Knorr, aye.
Knorr, aye. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, aye.
Novotny, aye. Representative Pearson?
Pearson, aye.
Pearson, aye. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Rasmussen?
Rasmussen, aye.
Rasmussen, aye. Representative Robbins?
Aye.
Robbins, aye. Representative Sandell?
Aye.
Sandell, aye. Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, aye.
Schumacher, aye. Thank you all. That's 19 ayes, Chair Schultz.
Okay. Thank you, members. The motion prevails. And on its way to the general register. Thank you, Representative Hansen. Let's see, we have two more bills left, and whatever we don't finish, we will finish on Friday at 10:30. So let's see if we can finish the next bill, which is House File 1335. Representative Frazier, this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome to the committee. I'll move the bill so it's before us. Please introduce yourself to the committee and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee, for hearing the bill. Madam Chair, I believe there may be an amendment that I'd need to have moved.
Okay, let me see if we have an amendment. Let me check with Yingya. Is it an A1 amendment?
A21.
A21 amendment. Okay. I will move the A21 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the motion is prevails and the amendment's adopted. To your bill as amended, Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Chair. So this House file is needed because it will allow the Commissioner of Health to approve a nursing home moratorium exception for a specific project located in the cities of New Hope and Corcoran. And specifically, we're talking about St. Therese. St. Therese does sit in the city of New Hope. I am very familiar with St. Therese. I reside in the city of New Hope, and I am a former council member in the city of New Hope. This project actually came up prior to the pandemic, so part of the reason for the amendment was to provide some adjustments based on that change in timeline. But St. Therese was built in 1968. It was the first Catholic-based campus in the metro area. St. Therese cares for approximately 2,000 residents across the country. The New Hope campus, which is the campus that is in the bill today, employs approximately 500 staff, making St. Therese of New Hope one of the largest employers in New Hope and the surrounding areas. St. Therese staff and board of directors believe in a continuum of care model. This model prevents transferring a loved one during each level of care, if needed, to another facility. Transfers are very hard for a senior, especially if they are ill. This model allows for spousal accommodations in the St. Therese apartments, with walking access to the campus to be close to their loved ones. This will be the first renovations for St. Therese since its initial construction in 1968, so over 50 years. These renovations will extend the life of the building by 15 to 20 years and will include updates to satisfy heating, ventilation, and air conditioning needs, which has become even more important as we've seen what's happened during the pandemic. With me today, I have from St. Therese, Barbara Rowe, the CEO, and Calvin Shelandowski, sorry if I mispronounced your name, the CFO. And Madam Chair, I would like to turn it over to these two to provide testimony for further details about this project.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. To Barb Rodi, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Okay, my name is Barb Rodi. I'm the president and CEO of St. Therese. I've just started my 20th year at St. Therese. So thank you, Madam Chair, for letting us be here. And a special thank you for Representative Frazier for bringing this forward. And thanks for all the members for being here. The reason why we're looking for this moratorium exception is because, like Representative Frazier said, our building is 53 years old. We have major plumbing problems there. Kind of disintegrating, and when you put new piping in, you have to displace people above and below those piping avenues. Right now, our heating and cooling system is a two-pipe system, which is very antiquated. It will only allow heat to be on or cooling to be on. And there's a couple of months in the year where it's very difficult to determine, okay, should we have the heat on or the cooling, or should we leave it alone? So we want to go to a four-pipe system, which will give us more air return and better control for the residents for the heating and cooling. As you've all known in the media, there's all about the pandemic, and this really solidified why we needed the moratorium. We were probably one of the first facilities in Minnesota to have residents that contracted the virus. And at that time, we followed all of CDC and MDH's requirements. And we, as you know, we didn't have PPE available. We couldn't purchase it, we couldn't do anything. So we, and at that time, CDC was stating that it is not airborne, the virus itself. But through our experience, we did figure out it was airborne. And at the beginning, we had no tests to test the residents because we wanted to put negatives with negatives and positive with positives. But we couldn't get that testing. You had to have symptoms to be able to get tested and bring that forward. So it was really like a crapshoot to figure out who was positive, who was not. And the employees were not allowed to get tested at all unless they could find a clinic that would test them. But at that time, there weren't any kits to have that happen. So eventually when we did get the amount of kits we needed, we were the first facility to test every resident all at once. And that really made a difference. We were able to know who was positive and who was negative. The only bad part about that is our employees still didn't get that test as soon as the residents could have, but it helped a great deal. We have our bedrooms are 2 residents to a room and 4 to a bathroom. So you can see the airflow is not a good situation and the space is not a good situation. So of course, private rooms really make a difference, and that's what we want to make sure that we're built for, is all private rooms. We did stop admissions as soon as we did have the first resident that had COVID. So until we were more stabilized, then if we ever got an admission, they had to have 2 negative tests before they came in. And all of this was done through CDC, through MDH. They surveyed us quite often for infection control. So the rebuilding of the care center really provides us an opportunity to put equipment into the building that would prevent or viruses. So when we found out and when we got everything stable, we did purchase 2 machines that go into the ventilation system that sprays out and kills any of the viruses. But that was at a cost of $45,000 just for 2 of them that only worked in, had a spread of maybe 15 rooms. So you can imagine what that cost was. So we've been researching a lot more on that. And what we're finding now is that if your humidity is 45% or above, the virus falls immediately to the floor. It doesn't stay hovering in the room. So those are the things we're looking for the rebuild, to make sure that we do all of the prevention we possibly can to make sure it doesn't spread. So right now, I would like to turn it over to Calvin Schellingowski for, if that's okay, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Rode. Mr. Okay. Schellingowski.
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for hearing this bill and for this opportunity. As you know, in order for a nursing home to be replaced in Minnesota, we are required to go through the moratorium exception process. We went through that process recently in 2019, but unfortunately we're not awarded due to the competitive nature and limited funding for the moratorium exception process. At that time, we had more semi-private rooms and, as Barb shared, shared spaces than any other nursing facility in the state. So as a result of the size of our project and this replacement and the date of the building and facility, we're asking and have, at least in the most recent round, for more than half of the funding that was available. The moratorium exception process has recently been released, and the amount of the ask from our most recent round is nearly the entire amount. So we are here today asking and trying to exhaust every avenue possible.
Mr. Schellingowski, can you state your name and affiliation for the record? I believe we skipped that part.
I apologize. My name is Calvin Schellingowski, and I'm the Chief Financial Officer for St. Therese.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Any closing comments? Or I'm sorry, here's a question. We have time for one question. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question actually goes to Mr. Schellingowski, is it?
It is.
Appreciate that. So you're going to be moving residents between a few various facilities in order to complete these renovations. Are these other facilities that these residents will be moving to, quote unquote, up to code? Certainly would not want to suggest, but you know, the prevalence of COVID in these environments, would you be introducing them to a similar circumstance only to bring it back into the newly renovated facility? And what is your contingency plan or the process you're following for making sure that that doesn't happen?
Mr. Shelangowski.
Yes, Representative Albright, thank you for your question. We would be relocating residents to the Corcoran area. That would be a newly constructed facility, and it would be constructed up to the current codes today. The plan that we brought forward through our moratorium application process was prior to the pandemic. So the relocation impact today would be very, very minimal compared to prior to the pandemic due to current occupancy.
Thank you. And Representative Brazier, go ahead, Mrs. Roy.
I just wanted to add to that that we have downsized and reduced 44 beds. And we did that because through attrition, we were not taking admissions. So we realized we tried to get some private rooms as fast as we could. So it does benefit the state that we have downsized and delicensed some beds. So the other beds that are going to Corcoran, that's about 80 residents that we get in our New Hope campus that could stay in their own community. They wouldn't have to come to New Hope and then have the relatives drive back and forth.
So thank you. We have to end the discussion now to end on time, but Representative Frazier, 30 seconds, closing comments.
I just hope to get the support from the committee, and I appreciate it being laid over for consideration. As we can see, the project needs to move forward. It hasn't been renovations in over 50 years. We can see what was laid to bear by the pandemic, that it's important to get these things modernized.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. Thank you, testifiers. So House File 335 will be laid over for possible inclusion. So members, we will discuss on Friday House File 1532, Representative Frederick, and two additional bills. But before we adjourn, I'm going to have Chair Fisher see if he can move the division report.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the Behavioral Health Division report, please.
Okay, Chair Fisher moves the division report from Behavioral Health. This is a voice vote. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed?
No.
The motion prevails and the division report is adopted.
Madam Chair, could you just specify, sorry to interrupt, could you just specify what the division report was on?
This is for House File 1532, which we'll take up on Friday.
Thank you.
Along with two additional bills. And this is the DHS policy bill and human services community supports. So I'm guessing there'll be lots of questions on that bill. So it's good that we have more time on Friday. So members, with that, thank you everyone for being here today. I know we processed a lot of bills. Thank you for your questions, and thank you to all of our testifiers and members who presented their bills. So with that, members, I will see everyone on Friday, and we are adjourned.